comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this planet, thank you for being here. I appreciate it, and I think you'll be delighted to be here as well. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. And by the way, it is the show where you matter. Do you know what the ISRO is? Sounds official, doesn't it? ISRO. Well, it is. It is the Indian Space Agency. It is India's version of NASA. It's their space agency. And they are, by the way, quite successful. They have announced that they will make the data that was beamed back from the Chandrayaan-1 moon craft. They're going to make it public by putting it on the internet. And they're going to do that by the end of this year. Now, what's interesting about that? Well, a lot of things are interesting about that. First of all, are you aware that the Chandrayaan-1 from India is the first moon craft to ever confirm the presence of water on the moon? They beat NASA to the announcement. Actually, I guess NASA beat them to the announcement. They beat NASA to the discovery. Or maybe they didn't. Maybe NASA already knew and just didn't want anybody else to know. Now, why do I say that? Well, I say that because there is something really weird that happened, and that is right after Chandrayaan-1 discovered water on the moon, it disappeared. And then NASA did their lacrosse mission where they crashed something into the moon and said, oh, look, water. So it'll be very interesting, I think, whenever Chandrayaan-1 data hits the internet. Very interesting indeed. There are going to be photographs, data, topographical maps, mineral maps for the moon. So I think it's going to be very interesting just from that standpoint. But also, since Chandrayaan-1 is the first to discover water on the moon, in all that data and all of those photographs, don't you wonder what else is there? What other big surprises there may be in there? I bet there are some. And they're going to put them out on the internet. You know, the Chandrayaan-1 just disappeared. Boom, just like that, right off of radar. I had people send me email and tell me, we don't have radar that can reach to the moon. Well, of course we do. We have radar that can not only reach to the moon, but is used to make photographs of the surface of the moon. And very clear photographs as well. Of course we do. It disappeared off a radar. Boom. Instantly. Just vanished. Kind of like the Mars Global Surveyor. Pardon me, a little something in my throat. If you're not signed up for our free weekly newsletter, be sure you do. It's called the K-Files, and you do it by going to my website, see where it says K-Files, and click it. And then you can subscribe for free. We'll be back right after this.
Thank you.
welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening. My guest this evening is William Warwick IV, and you know him from various places. You've seen him on YouTube, you've seen him on, or heard him on this show and other shows. He is responsible for a film, or at least partially responsible, maybe all responsible, we'll find out, for a film that came out about the Phoenix Lights. And he's returning here tonight. We're going to be talking about a couple of things that should be of great interest to you, and I think they will be. William, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're glad to have you back.
How you doing, Kevin? Good to be back again.
William, first, let's clear that up about the film. Are you a producer about that, or with that, or what?
Well, I was the principal investigator, and I teamed up with Surrey Seminars to produce and hold a UFO conference, which was actually featured by ABC News Nightline, and to document, you know, the witnesses that we had that had come forward for the Phoenix Lights event, which we prefer to call the Phoenix incident rather than just the Phoenix Lights, because it kind of it tends to distract attention away from the actual events rather than just the flare sightings that were seen later on in the night, and other things that could be mistaken for, you know, things other than actual craft, you know, that could be identified by pilots and stuff like that we have testimony from. And that was the Phoenix incident. We won best new investigative documentary film for 2008 from the New York Independent International Film Festival, so we're pretty happy about that. And we're working on a project right now, actually, with an actor and producer and a childhood friend of mine, actually, from back in South Boston, Jay Giannone, who's appeared in Gone Baby Gone, The Departed, Three Kings, and Good Will Hunting, and a number of other movies that took place in Boston. So things are kind of moving along as far as the story is concerned and getting out some of the information that, you know, that we've been able to uncover over the past decade and couple of 13 years, I guess, now. So we're just real happy to see things progressing along.
Well, that's good. I'm glad, always glad to hear when something's working good for people, and especially in the genre in which I work. I hear so many stories where things are not going well, so it's good to hear things going well. All right, now you have done some work, some research into, actually it's an incident, a series of incidents, that take us back in time, and, they're very famous, these incidents. Just about everyone knows about them, and only a few, I think, would make any connection with this genre. And I mean, I don't think most people would connect the Fatima visions. I don't think they would connect that with the genre of UFOs. But you've done some research in that, and you've come up with some what you think are connections. So let's talk about that. Tell us first a little bit, because there are some people who will not have heard of the Fatima visions. So tell us a little bit about those, and then we'll talk about these connections.
Well, the Fatima events are named after a series of what have been called Virgin Mary apparition sightings that occurred in the town of an area of Fatima, Portugal, which is on the west. If you know where Spain is, it's on the western part of Spain. It's its own country. And for a long time, just to give you some idea of the history of that particular area, in particular, the Romans used to call it Lusitania, which, if you translate it, literally means land of the lights. And just recently, actually, there have been some research that was done, which is funded by the Portuguese government, and there are a couple of researchers just within the past couple of years that uncovered a lot of basically Vatican documents, or documents that the Vatican wasn't able to suppress that still had existed but really hadn't been looked at either by the Vatican themselves in 70 years or whatever. And they came out with a couple of books, which you can get online, through Amazon.com if you'd like to do some of your own research. But basically, what they were able to uncover was the fact that the events that you know, history is written down as having occurred and being apparitions with the Virgin Mary, if you go back when the way that they did and looked at the actual eyewitness accounts and descriptions of what they saw and heard and felt and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then a different picture began to emerge. And the picture that began to emerge was that these children of this one particular family, they were cousins, they were Jacinta and the two cousins, and only one of the children allegedly was able to listen to or see the Virgin Mary, when in fact, you know, it appears that a lot of them, the three of them were able to see what we would call today orbs, orbs of light, which we see, you know, you hear about them all the time. I've seen them personally, I'm sure you have too, and probably many of the people that have listened have seen these things and wonder what they are. And when they got more into the story of what was going on, it wasn't just the main event, which was predicted by the children to occur on October 13th. It was just a series of events that led up to that. You know, the big event that we get from the Catholic Church that says that it's, you know, the one mysterious thing that they really couldn't explain, which they call the miracle of the sun, when the sun apparently came down out of the sky and twirled around, and, you know, some kind of radiation was released and it dried it, everyone's clothes, and then, you know, went back up in the sky and disappeared. And anywhere from 30 to 70,000 people are estimated to have seen this event. So basically what you've got is the idea, or the revelation, I guess you could say, of the cover-up of what would otherwise have gone down in history as you know, a UFO contact of the magnitude that was only repeated one time, in my opinion, since, and that was at the Phoenix Lights incident in Phoenix, Arizona, on March 13th, 1997.
Okay, but, I mean... Okay, look, I'm going to play the devil's advocate just a little bit.
Sure.
And I normally, you know, I'm the guy that says, now look, folks, you know, you say, you know, those of you who are very, very religious and you say there are no such things as extraterrestrials, I'm the guy who says, well, what do you think your God is? He's not from here. If he's not from here, what does that mean? He's extraterrestrial. He's not from here. That's what extraterrestrial means. So I'm that guy. But I'm going to get on the other side of the fence for just a moment, because I think there are some questions that we need to hear the answers to, okay? So the first question is, these children, or at least one of them, said that this apparition of Mary gave a message each time it happened, right?
Yes, to the older girl.
Uh-huh. She became a nun, didn't she?
Yeah, a cloistered nun at that, yes. She was basically locked up in the Vatican in Coimbra, I believe, the Coimbra convent in Coimbra, Portugal. And she actually wrote down three prophecies which were given to the Bishop of Leiria and held supposedly till the 1954, 1956. And then it was passed on, and then allegedly was passed back and forth. You know, the Pope would allegedly have it, and then he wouldn't read it and send it back. I mean, just these ridiculous things, you know, about
okay.
The prophecy.
All right, okay, but I think people who are on the side of this being, not, it is certainly not terrestrial, but not alien. I think that's how they would view it. People that are very, very religious, I think they would say, okay, this is not terrestrial, but it's not alien. It's another class of something happening. It's miraculous, and it's the Virgin Mary. And as proof, or as evidence, maybe not proof, but as evidence of that, they would point to those prophecies and say, would the ETs be giving these prophecies to this girl, and would she wind up being a nun if these were ETs? This, they would say, is evidence that it was, in fact, Mary. So what would you say?
Well, wait a second. So what you're saying then is that if it was a real ET occurrence, that they would or wouldn't have?
I think religious people would say that the presence of the prophecies would be evidence that this is actually an apparition of Mary and not an ET. So what would you say?
Well, there's a couple things to remember, though, here, that when she wrote down the prophecies, I don't think it was supposedly until 1939 or 1940, somewhere in that period of time. I don't recall her actually writing down the prophecies, and I believe that she was sworn to secrecy by the Virgin Mary, which is a familiar thing. And so I don't know that at the time, even as all those things had occurred, people will tend to see what they want to see, even if their eyes are telling them that it's one thing. They're going to try to, their brain's going to try and relate that to whatever they is more comfortable to their particular belief system. So Muslims see, the daughter of Muhammad, who's Fatima, which actually the town was named after, by the way. I think there's a message in and of itself right there. Or, you have Christians who see the Virgin Mary, or you see, have Buddhists who see, the mother of Buddha. I mean, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that people will have a tendency, depending on what particular belief system they have grown up in, to see certain things. Now, the one exception to that would be the Zaytun, Egypt apparitions of Mary, where most of the people, like 80% of the population, was Islamic, was Muslim, and they still reported seeing the Virgin Mary and described sort of a Christian description of that particular apparition, even though those people were clearly not of that particular religion. So there seems to be something that has been occurring throughout history, because if you look at it in and of itself, you can almost dismiss it. But if you go throughout history and you go just a little bit further back, you get Bernadette from Lourdes, who also had interactions with some type of being. It's called a supernatural being, if you don't want to call it an alien, and was told to dig into the ground and eat the ground and et cetera, and all of a sudden a well popped up out of nowhere. When people go to this day, it's still springing forth water to this day, and then you go back before that, and there were other in that particular area, of Lower France and Upper Spain, Catalonia, et cetera, where you have all these different types of Virgin Mary apparitions going back for a couple hundred years, actually, always with the female, always with young females. And always sort of these messages of impending doom that are coming up in the near future, which actually tended to come true.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the fact that these children interpreted this as being an apparition of Mary is because that's the framework they had to work with, and they're projecting that onto the event.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you also have to take in consideration that the Catholic Church put their own particular spin on it.
Well, first, they tried to stomp it out.
Well, I mean, at that particular time, this is an interesting footnote, that particular time, most of Portugal was ruled by Freemasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the Catholic Church put their particular spin on it and turned it into a supernatural, miraculous event, rather than trying to look at it from a scientific point of view and to try and figure out or blend some kind of investigation into it. It's much easier to dismiss things as UFOs, ghosts, and et cetera, just to make people sort of just stop thinking about it. Once you put a label on it, then it's pretty much dead. Once you think that you've described it a certain way, you called it a UFO or an alien or an extraterrestrial, there's a certain part of certain people that just shuts off automatically, and And that works to the advantage of the people that, that benefit from those types of systems. But I think as things go on and as these systems that we've already have start to fall apart, more and more people are going to come to the realization there's a lot more going on if we just stop to, you know, smell the roses, I think you could say.
Have you taken a look at these prophecies of Fatima?
Sure. Study them in depth.
Okay, we're going to talk about those a little bit on the other side of the break. Before now, we've got about 3 minutes here, two and a half minutes before we get to break, and we're going to get to some of those prophecies on the other side. But before we do that, I'd like for you to enlighten us a little bit as to what is it about Fatima that made you say, I think that's a UFO.
Well, I can't go into it in too much detail, but basically the events that transpired when I was a child in Sandy Hill, which we talked about in a previous interview. But beyond that, what really made the connection pretty solid with me and made me really investigate it a lot more and then realize that there were other connections that I hadn't first seen was that Jim DeLatesso, who I'm sure you know, had done a comparison of the photographs that were taken from various, you know, events that happened in Phoenix during the Phoenix Lights events. And he tried to match them up spectrally, I guess, to other sources of light. I don't know all the technical details. I'm sure people could, you know, come up with some kind of refutation of whatever evidence he seems to have gathered. But the bottom line is that he had made a connection or actually a match, and the spectral match that he had got for the Phoenix Lights, not all of them, I'm assuming, you know, a certain set of data, matched and could and only would match the ones that they got from photographs that were taken of the Miracle of the Sun event that still exist from Fatima, Portugal. And so that was really, you know, I had kind of suspected that there might be a connection, but until I actually saw that little piece of information, I really didn't believe it. And not in the sense that I believed that there were still other things that had to come before I actually would believe that, you know, that, that there was something going on here, there was a message behind the message. And it's the message of simple mathematics, and that was that the dates of the events were all revolved around the number 13, which seems like a silly thing to just say, but really if you look at the evidence and you look at the way things transpired, it definitely seems to have been some sort of subliminal message that 13.
What was the date for the Phoenix incident?
March 13th.
Yeah. We'll be back right after this, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, William Warwick IV. We're talking about Fatima, the visions at Fatima, and the connection that he thinks exists with UFOs. And we're talking about why he thinks that connection is there. Now, William, before we went to break, I said on the other side of that break, I wanted to get into these prophecies just a little bit. And let's see if there is... well, we'll just get into the prophecies, and then I'll tell you what we'll see. I'll tell you what I'm looking for once we're into it. So, what's the first prophecy about?
There were... You could call them prophecies or secrets.
Okay.
One of the tenets that she wanted to portray to the children, that she wanted to convey to us being humans or whatever you want to look at it as, was to, in order to save, you know, the earth, basically, God wishes to establish in the world devotion to my Immaculate Heart, which basically means that she wanted to devotion to all of the principles of the Virgin Mary, you know, principles, which is basically love, you know, and charity and all of those, you know, very, very good things, in terms of social justice, I guess you could say.
Okay, so the first one is basically be good Catholics.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
In which, again, you have to understand, this is what's passed down through the Catholic Church. You know, what was actually written by her, what was actually, you know, said by her, no one really knows, because this has all come through the filter of the Catholic Church. So, and many people believe that there were, you know, these are not the actual, what she said, and I wholeheartedly believe that too. But this is what has been passed down. The second one was that if people attended to her requests, that Russia will be converted and the world will have peace.
Russia will be converted.
Converted to Catholicism, or, you know, converted from, you know, they actually call it not evil ways, erring ways, or their errors, meaning communism. Again, you know, filtered through the Catholic Church, and the world will have peace. So at the time this was announced, it was in 1941, and Sister Lucia stated that she was not permitted to reveal the third part of the secret. So those were the first two things. The third part was not revealed. And Bishop De Silva was given permission to read it, but he allegedly did not want the responsibility to try to send it to the office of the Holy See in Rome. But Rome refused to receive it, if you believe that. It was then agreed that if Bishop De Silva happened to die, the envelope would then be entrusted to Cardinal Sarajevo, the Patriarch of Lisbon, the capital city of Portugal. And then, you know, the story just goes on and on with this, you know, an incredible string of passing the envelope back and forth. No one, you know, someone would peek at it and put it back and say they didn't read it. It's just ridiculous. So obviously, whatever the third secret was, it was so volatile that they just, you know, they didn't even want to touch it. They didn't want to misinterpret it. They just held it, I think. You know what I mean? Because
I understand there was a pope that looked at it and fainted. Pope John.
In 54. In 1957, the Holy Office demanded the text of the third secret, which until then had been kept at the palace of the Bishop of Illyria. The auxiliary bishop was entrusted with the delivery of the sealed document to Bishop Cento, then the apostolic nuncio to Lisbon. And it just goes on and on and on and on from them. In 1957, the sealed envelope arrived in Rome. It was placed in the office of Pope Pius the 12th, and a little chest bearing the note "Secret of the Holy Office." And then, you know, it goes on to even John Paul, and this is how you know that they've definitely, you know, tweaked it, and they definitely haven't understood all of it. Was that Pope John Paul II was supposed to have met with Sister Lucia, who died actually in 2005, so she's been around for a long time, and was supposed to have met with her at the last minute he had one of his emissaries meet with Sister Lucia instead, and he had written a letter to her, and in the letter he had said that he wanted to go over some of the things that were in the third secret that, you know, he basically, it sounded like he didn't understand. Most people will say that it has to deal with the apostasy of the church. And that's just a complicated word that just means it's basically the end of the church, you know.
Yeah, the corruption.
Right. Well, the revelation of the corruption of the church.
All right. Now, what I found was interesting, John the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd, who preceded Pope John Paul the II. Pope John the 23rd is alleged to have looked at this. It was on a single page. They said he fainted. When he came to, he ordered that it be sealed up and locked away forever. John Paul had it brought out, and allegedly they released what it was about. And it was three pages. It was not a single. It was not the one page. It was three pages. So something happened.
Yeah, and again, you know, this this also assumes that it wasn't translated by the bishops of Lisbon and wasn't kept secret there as well, because really the only person that Sister Lucia really trusted or was allowed to trust or had trust in were the actual her own people, which were the people of Portugal. And the bishops and other people that were in control of that local, you know, particular area, that had believed in her from, you know, some of them from the beginning. And so I think that it's quite possible that there's a story within the story within the story that still hasn't come out yet, and that's part of what I'm trying to do with, you know, some of the information that I've been able to gather. And certainly coming up now in 2012, it really seems to just gel in a way that, I mean, I never could have predicted that I would end up in this particular place, you know, talking about these things in relationship to UFOs. But it's sort of come full circle.
Well, Russia has not been converted, and there is not world peace.
Well, and again, but if you look at it from the viewpoint of that particular prophecy coming out in 1941, just before, there was actually another part of that prophecy that's a truncated version of it. There was another part that said that when you see strange lights in the sky, then you know that, you know, that the chastisement is right around the corner. And apparently there was some type of event that occurred right before the outbreak of World War II, and that many believe was that the Night of Lights, or whatever you want to call it, that was part of the fulfilling of that second prophecy, in the sense that, you know, which is kind of funny, because you know, the Russians, why not the Nazis? Why focus on the Russians? Again, it seems like it was filtered through, you know, the Vatican and the Western sort of ideals.
Well, at that time, the Vatican was partners with, in some ways, partners with the Nazis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. To help them get away into America, Operation Paperclip and stuff like that, there's no question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now... I want to throw this question at you. Do you think that the text of the prophecies, or the text of the visions, whatever you want to call them, do you think that all three of these are suspect, and that we have not actually been told the truth as to the content of any of them? Or do you think that some of it is true, and if so, which part?
Well, I think that the Vatican did a very good job of wrapping up the truth in a lie, or wrapping up a lie in truth, let's put it that way. And, you know, I think that there are parts of what have come out of that particular, you know, revelation, so to speak, that do kind of ring true, but ring true through, you know, the filter of some, you know, whether you call it the Vatican or whatever you want to call it. But it's definitely, I don't think we're getting the full picture, definitely not. And especially in relationship to the third secret, because that seems to have been such a hot potato. And think about it, what would really cause the downfall more of the Roman Catholic Church than the revelation that the Virgin Mary and all of these other sightings that have occurred throughout our history, that we wrote about in the Bible and the Quran, or all of other holy documents, are nothing more than extraterrestrial humans, meaning, you know, just human beings from other planets interacting with us, you know, in maybe not such good ways all the time. And
I say religion is fiction. There are people who hate me for that until they really stop and think about it. I'm not saying the Bible is fiction. Some people would say that. I'm not. I'm saying religion. That's what man has built up around these writings. And religion's not in the Bible. That's man-made. Religion's man-made.
You know, you take it all the way back to, you know, that's really what the brother of John, Jesus, you know, the Johannites, and some of these, you know, sort of core religious sects that around during those times were really all about, was that you didn't need to have a church or a temple or anything like that to be spiritual and commune with God. All you got to do is walk outside and look at the trees and smell the air and look at the stars, and, you know, there you are. You're a part of the universe. That's all you need to commune with God. And that became a pagan sort of, you know, what we would call today a pagan religion, but was really a religion focused on you know, a spirituality that didn't involve, you know, enslavement to a particular dogma. And so, obviously, today, you know, look at where that enslavement to a dogma has taken us. And we're,
but, yeah, okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because the same thing is happening with the religion of UFOs. There are people that are turning UFOs into religious belief.
Sure.
And they're fervent about it. They're urgent about it. If you don't believe it like they believe it, then by God, you're going to UFO hell. You know, I mean, they don't say that, but that's their attitude.
And
it's becoming a religion just as much as the other religions are.
Sure. And you know me for many years now, and just because I'm revealing these things that I've learned about this doesn't mean that I believe in every single thing that has, you know what I'm saying, that the whole picture. I mean, I reserve judgment until I see something or I feel that I've got enough evidence that I can make some kind of conclusion on something. And the last thing that you want to do is set these people up as being the gods, even if they are the gods of our prehistory, you know what I'm saying? The,
the
human creators of us, who, that's what it says in the Bible. You know, why shouldn't we believe it? Even if it's the watered-down version of that creation story, right? But the fact still remains that these events, these, you know, so-called UFO, so-called angelic, so-called whatever you label you want to put on it, have been written down in art through secrets. Some of the secret symbols are more secret than others, you know. You got to know what you're looking for in some of these things. And, you know, in the history, the verbal history, the Mahabharata, if you just look at a comparative religion standpoint, you see the same stories over and over again. Gods that flew. Well, maybe they really did have a technology that was much more advanced than what we have today. Now, let's fast forward to today's future where, yeah, you're right. You've got people out there that believe that UFOs are a religion and, you know, they're waiting for one foot to land and they're going to worship that, but whatever comes out of that door, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's dangerous, too, because our government has these particular types of craft. And it's my understanding that today we can't really even tell the difference between a UFO craft of one particular construction and a man-made replica.
Okay, William, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is William Warwick IV, and we have been talking about Fatima and the connection that he sees between that and UFOs. I've got a question. You mentioned early in the show that the Roman name for Portugal was Lusitania, right?
Yes, it certainly was.
And you said that means the land of lights.
Yep.
Why did they name it that?
Because people have been seeing lights, strange lights in that area since the Roman times and before. There's all mythology related to it. I don't remember all of it, but there's stories related to it. I also believe, I have to look it up, but I believe Lusitania was the daughter of one of the Greek gods or something like that. So, I mean, there's a whole, you know, history, so to speak, of things that, again, you know, prior to the 20th century and the advent of the technological industrial revolution, we would have simply always have described them as angelic or, you know, religious events. Again, you know, a Muslim would say, you know, I saw Allah come and, you know, take me away and ride on his boomerang to Mecca, which Muhammad allegedly did, you know, in one night and then came back, you know, explain how they did that. Again, you know, the history is there if you care to look for it and if you care to, you know, take a look at what's already in plain sight, really. And it's more or less a psychological, you have to be open to it. You know,
if you don't
go looking for it, you're not going to find anything. You
know? All right, I'm looking, and what I'm looking for is why there were so many lights in the sky that they named the whole place Lusitania, because it means light, the land of lights. There's so much of that going on. They named it Lusitania, and we don't hear about too much going on in Portugal today with UFOs.
Well, actually, in 2006, I went to Fatima on September 13th, 2006, which is one of the holier days that people go there, obviously, on the 13th. And that's part of the issue, the whole numerology of the events. One of the interesting things that came out right before I went to Fatima was allegedly off the coast of southern Lisbon, which is basically the southeast coast of Spain, let's call it Spain, right by the gates of Gibraltar in that area there, on the Portugal side of the water, was a huge triangular area, which when it was geomapped at the time, there was some scuttlebutt that said that they thought that might have actually been an underground, some type of underground structure, or base, you know.
Underground or underwater?
Underwater, my bad, underwater, yeah. And you could actually see it, you know, at the time, Google Earth, I believe. Uh-huh. And there is definitely some sort of triangular, sort of, you know, non-linear, so to speak, angles going on there that seem to be a little demand a little bit more attention, I guess you could say. But that might be one explanation. And as you know, many, many Navy guys have come forward in the past just, you know, 10 years or so. All types of Navy guys have come forward. And of course, I live here in Norfolk, Virginia, the largest naval base in the world. And, you know, there's quite a few admirals that retire and U-boat captains and what have you. And the stories that I hear are, you know, there's more UFO sightings and there's more stuff going on in the ocean than there is on land, you know. And if that's true, then my God, you know, that's 70% more than what we're actually seeing. So, you know, it's not such a far-fetched idea. If an admiral or U-boat captain tells you, you know, that these things exist and they don't know what they are, you know, you tend to believe it. They're
In Roman times, they called it Lusitania, which means land of lights, because they were seeing so many lights in the sky. And people are not seeing that now. Apparently not in Lusitania.
Well, you got to remember, Portugal is a socialist country now, and it's still ruled very much by the Roman Catholic Church. You know, it's still very staunchly Roman Catholic. So, you know, it's pretty old school in many respects. I love the country, by the way. I'd love to go back. We went to Madeira Island as well, and I don't know.
So you think maybe they are seeing it and they're being suppressed? The news is being suppressed. Is that what you're saying?
I think they're far less likely to report it.
Yeah, but see, you have the Vatican now saying it's okay to believe in extraterrestrials.
Actually, let me take it one step further, and now that I think of it, they have a ban on the Internet. You can't not talk about UFOs or any of those keywords. UFOs come under what they call the occult. They have like an occult act. They call it the occult something or other. And they ban those websites, because when I was in Portugal and tried to look up like shows like yours to listen in on what was going on or whatever, they were banned.
So I'm banned in Portugal, huh?
I would have to have that confirmed by one of your listeners, but as far as I know, yeah, your website will definitely not
banned in Portugal.
Hey,
all right.
I mean, you should make up a list of places you've been. That's pretty cool, in my opinion.
I've got a list of places where I have audience. I think Portugal is on the list.
Well, so hey, they might be getting it serendipitously, you know.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. All right. So Lusitania, the land of lights, and now it is occult to talk about these lights, and occult, of course, means that means hidden. What's interesting, by the way, folks, you do know in Spanish, and I think in Portuguese as well, the word for a worship service at a church is cultos. Cult. Cultos.
Hmm.
How about that? Okay, so maybe I am banned for being ocultos.
Ocultos, yeah. And again, that may have a different connotation than what we think of it as, because I believe that was in Portuguese, but that's all a romantic language, Latinized language, so I'm sure it means, hidden stuff that you're not supposed to be reading.
Yeah, well,
we don't want to ruin your mind.
Let me encourage any of our listeners in Portugal to send me an email and let me know about this. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm just curious. Am I banned in Portugal? And you're getting the show some other way? If I am, I'd love to know. Banned in Portugal. I'm not even banned in China. I've got an audience in China. I'm not banned there. In fact, I have audience, can you believe this, in Iran. I'm not banned in Iran.
I believe it.
Yeah, I've got audience there. In fact, all over the Middle East, including all the Arab countries and Israel. And, of course, Iran is not Arab. I was surprised to discover I have listeners in Iran, and I'm glad I do. We've got Fatima. That's a well-established, or at least in the minds of the public, it's a well-established event of some spiritual consequence. And then we've got William Warwick IV, who says, well, yeah, but it is very likely that it's a UFO event. We're going to talk about that just a little bit more on the other side of the break that's coming up, and then we're going to get into another event that may not be what you have been told. Okay, William, other than it sounds as if it kind of could, maybe, sort of, might be a UFO event, is there anything about this that really pops its head up and says, hey, you know what, this is probably a UFO event?
Well, the main event that would get tagged as a UFO event would obviously be the Miracle of the Sun, which is predicted to have occurred on October 13th, and was told to by this entity called the Virgin Mary, or call it an entity, call it whatever you want, that I believe it was on the June or July 13th visitation between the children and the apparition, when Lucia, if I recall correctly, asked what her name was, I believe she responded, I am the Immaculate Heart of Mary, or something along those lines. And then there was another interaction, I believe Lucia said, you know, can you give us some kind of sign? You know, the people really don't believe us that these things are going on. You know, they can't see you, blah, 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 blah. And the apparition responded that, keep on coming to see me on the 13th of every month. On October 13th, I will show everyone, you know, I'll give you a sign that no one can deny.
All right. And no one can deny that we're going to break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. And sorry you missed several universes of information already, but we're glad you're here now. My guest is William Warwick IV. And William, we had to go to break just as you were beginning to talk to me about why... I said, is there anything that kind of pops its head up and says, okay, this is probably a UFO event? other than it's something in the sky and strange prophecies came from it, you know. And you were telling us that the event of the sun, and I think about 70,000 people saw this. You said this recommends itself as a UFO event. I want you to go a little bit more in depth on that, because so far, if I had to vote, I couldn't vote that direction.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at everything that had happened up until that particular point in time, it actually follows the same pattern as in general, as the Bernadette of Lourdes apparition encounters, and there were a bunch of more obscure ones before that, which all involved basically, it appears to be the same female bloodline, by the way, which is a curious and anecdotal footnote. But on October 13th, which is the prophesied day that she would give the sign to all peoples, that to let them know that this was really going on and it wasn't just a child's imagination, because you have to remember that apparently only Sister Lucia could see the entity, and it was only apparently on the last particular day, just before the miracle they call the miracle of the sun occurred on October 13th, 1917. Her two siblings, the two cousins, were not able to see the entities until that day. And then, of course, the rest of the people, some people reported seeing entities up in the tree, and some people didn't. You know, it was just one of those, you get varying stories on that. But long story short, the part of this whole thing, so basically what I'm trying to say is, up until that point in time, this followed a repeating pattern, so to speak, of similar events that had occurred through that area. Now, the one thing that sets this apart from all the other ones is, first of all, you know, people were told that a sign was going to occur. Obviously, 30 to, you know, estimates up to 70,000 people wouldn't have shown up on this little hillside in the middle of nowhere, basically, to look for something if they didn't think it was going to happen. And it just wasn't religious people. I mean, these were journalists, there were scientists, there were doctors. I mean, it was people from all walks of life. It just wasn't a bunch of Roman Catholic, you know, devout Christians, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that set this apart from all the rest of it was the description that was universally described of the event that occurred. And the event that occurred, which was described to have occurred, was that it was pouring rain out. I mean, the place was just, you know, festering in mud. And all of a sudden, the clouds, you know, parted in the sky, and the sun shone, and an object began to appear. It looked like it was, you know, part of or inside of the sun, so to speak. And as this object first appeared, it was given off, you know, dazzling lights and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it began to grow. What they described it as growing in size. And as it grew in size, it also appeared to come closer to them and filled up the whole, you know, view of what before that was a view of the sun, to the point where this round circular object was now, to them, appeared to be the sun. And people described it as, it looked like the sun was going to crash into the earth. Well, in order for that description, no matter what it was that they saw, to be accurate, it has to really describe an object that was in space, probably in our outer atmosphere, and of considerable size, mind you, that was positioned between us, or I should say Fatima, in this particular case, and the sun. In other words, if you drew a line between Fatima in the middle of the sun, this object would be in between those two points, so that the same way that we get the eclipse effect with the moon being between us and the sun, and we have a solar eclipse, basically this craft was creating its own eclipse. Because what it was
wouldn't it necessarily need to be approximately the size of the moon in order to do that?
I don't know that we could. We would have to know. We would have to have very specific data about the size of the craft when it was at its closest point.
Well, yeah, you're right.
I mean, you know, you would need a couple reference points in order to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
But certainly, for it to have been, here's the key, for it to have been far enough away that it would have been engulfed by, you know, the glare of the sun, basically. and been able to have come close enough to the Earth to have filled up their field of view of 70,000 people, right, mind you,
mm-hmm.
right? So that to them it would appear that the sun was going to crash into the Earth. Now, that's not a meteorological effect that's ever been described ever in the course of history. You know, you would think that if it's happened once before, people have written it down and we'd have a record of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously something else, you know, happened. And let's not forget that it was predicted to have happened. So you can't write that off as a meteorological event. You could write off the lights. And here's the key thing about that obviously whoever was in charge of that particular craft wanted future historians to realize and set this event apart as different from all the other events, because if the people had just seen lights in the sky, like we see today, UFOs,
yeah.
just lights in the sky, we don't know what it is, right?
Right.
It would just have gotten swept under the, you know what I'm saying? But that's not what happened. They created an effect, which, in effect, could only have been created by an object that was in space, that was big enough and had the ability to move fast enough from one specific point in space, outer space, basically, to an inner space, atmospheric level. And here's another interesting thing. One of the interesting things that was described by the people universally is that when the craft was closest to the Earth and it's giving off all these sparks around the radius and it's, you know, things are going crazy and people are on the ground, you know, praying to Virgin Mary, please, you know, don't kill me, et cetera, praying, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, you could see the pictures. You could see the people's faces. I mean, they look like, you know, something was coming. You could just see it. And one of the things, one of the strange effects that all of them described was that prior, again, you have to remember, it was pouring rain out when this event occurred at around noontime. And after the UFO, or whatever you want to call it, had left the area, had started to just, you know, go away from the Earth again, the people all looked around and realized that their clothes were completely dry. And I thought about that, and I said, well, let's go with the premise that this is a UFO. If it is a UFO, it's obviously using, it's manipulating gravity somehow in order to be able to travel that quickly through space without creating friction and all kinds of other issues. Or maybe it did create friction. But the point is that they were using some type of gravity manipulation in order to travel through space. Well, if they're manipulating gravity, then by definition, they're manipulating space-time. And so what if it was possible that whatever radiation was coming from that craft, when it was closest to the people on the Earth, that it not only created a radiation which was probably infrared, which was warm enough to dry their clothes, but not warm enough to necessarily cause any kind of harm to them, but that there was a time dilation for all of the people that were within the radiation halo of that particular craft, in the sense that perhaps what seemed to them a couple of seconds might have actually been a couple of minutes. You know, not quite long enough to cause any long-term effects or damages to them, but long enough so that there would be this one other particular strange event that future historians could look at and say, well, what if this was this, and what if this happened because of that? You know, if you just follow the logical stream, it explains all of those events, that it was a UFO, that there was some type of radiation emitted, which, you know, caused their clothes to be dried, and that this really was some type of, you know, perhaps extraterrestrial encounter. On a grand proportion.
Well, I guess you know that there will be among the faithful at least two groups. One, a group that do not feel threatened at all if there is some sort of explanation for something miraculous. And they would see this as regardless of whether it was a UFO or not, even if it was a UFO, it was a miracle sent by God. There's that group. And then there's the group that will be feel very threatened by this and very opposed to any such explanation. Have you talked about all of this in any open groups, any conferences or anything?
No, actually, the last interview that we had was the first time I've ever discussed it openly.
I wonder, you know, what the response would be in an open conference. I wonder. I guess it would depend on what group the conference was marketed to.
Absolutely.
But anything that people have come to attach religion to in any way, they get very defensive about it. And look, there are people that are that way about Zechariah Sitchin and his books. And then on the other side, there are people that way about Michael Heiser and his translations, and in opposition to Sitchin. And they're divided up in religiously divided up into camps, almost like religious denominations. And that's in the UFO community.
Oh, well, science in and of itself is a religious cult.
Yes, it is.
For the most part. You know, it doesn't really engender free thinking and all these other things that we come to, you know, teach our children that they do. You've really got to be a maverick, you know, to get anywhere. You can't really get that far within the quote unquote system. I mean, you could try, don't get me wrong, but you know, for the most part, things are so dogmatic, whether it's scientific or religious, that, you know, we've got all these problems in the world and we just can't seem to figure them out. And they're, all of these things are related. Because,
well, speaking of being a maverick, obviously, this, I'm going to call it a theory, this theory of yours that this is a UFO event. Certainly is not establishment thinking. It's more maverick thinking. It's outside the box. And I like that kind of thinking. Whether I decide I think it's true or I decide I think it's not accurate, either way, it's outside the box, and I like it. It gives me something, gives my mind something to work on and to ask questions about and to examine and to investigate. And outside the box is where all that happens. But you're an outside the box kind of guy because you also have a theory about a particular plane crash, an A-10, and you have spoken publicly about this. Let's talk about that just a little bit. We may come back to Fatima, but let's talk about that. This would be the plane piloted by Captain Button.
Yes, U.S. Air Force Captain Craig Button from Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Gila Bend, Arizona, was a pilot who was training with the 354th Fighter Wing, I believe it was. Just to recap the events that transpired around his disappearance, 2 weeks prior to the alleged disappearance of Captain Button, the Phoenix Lights events occurred on March 13th, 1997. The military quickly denied any involvement, quickly denied any kind of aircraft were up in the air on that particular night as an explanation, or I should say a non-explanation, of any kind of involvement with the events that occurred that night. And then not even 2 weeks after that, on April 2nd, 1997, you have a decorated Air Force captain, Craig Button, allegedly going off on a routine training mission with 4 live MK-500 bombs to, he allegedly broke formation with his 2 other wingmen, flew 800 miles across 2 states, and allegedly committed suicide by crashing his jet into the side of a mountain. Now, it should be noted here with extreme, how shall I say it, clarity that there were 4 live MK-500-pound bombs that were never recovered. And, in fact, there are seismographs all around that area maintained by different colleges and organizations, and they never picked up anything that would indicate either a plane crash nor 1, 2, 3, or 4 other seismic events that would indicate that a 500-pound bomb had been dropped in the area. Even if it didn't go off, it would still leave a seismic. It would still leave a low frequency.
There'd be a little blip.
Monitors. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so we don't have a blip for a plane crash. We don't have a blip for any of the 4 bombs.
Nope.
But what do we got?
Well, what we got is a search investigation that, although the military said in their own reports that they had an infrared event that had occurred around the same time, and they could locate that infrared event to, I believe it was Snowflake Mountain in Colorado. You know, none of the story adds up. Let's just put it this way: the military says that they had an infrared event that occurred, but we don't have a seismic event, which would indicate a plane crashing into the side of a mountain, or four bombs for other seismic events. You know, of those bombs being released prior to crashing into the mountain. You follow me? So.
Okay. Well, now wait. You know, hang on a second. What do we mean when? What does the Air Force mean? When they use the terminology infrared event, what is an infrared event?
Well, they're talking about a DPMS, a defense satellite, picking up an infrared event in a certain area and making a recording of it. So if they had the recording of the infrared event, which is basically almost real-time continuous, obviously, you know, I can't imagine that information was more than, you know, 24 hours old since they were looking for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why did it take them, you know, almost 22 days to get to the crash site and to try to get, you know, some kind of rescue? I was in civil air patrol. I was in search and rescue. I know how those operations are run. And everyone that I've talked to that was involved with that operation said that, you know, something really weird was going on. They weren't following protocol, you know. And there were, and again, there were some storms that were occurring at that time off and on, and it wasn't a very rugged area. But the bottom line is that if you don't have at least one seismic event, then you really don't have a plane crash. And if you really don't have a plane crash, then you have to question whether or not the debris that was found on that mountain was actually his plane. And then furthermore, they allegedly, when they did recover his remains, Craig Button's remains, you know, 27 days later, I believe it was, after he was missing, they said within that they would have a DNA match within, it was like, you know, less than 72 hours or something like that. And someone else, not me, a friend of mine, an Air Force airline captain actually, brought up the point that back then he didn't think that that they could replicate the DNA and match it that quickly. Because what you do when you get DNA samples, you actually replicate it, and then you try and match it up with another DNA sample. And it takes a while to do that, and they didn't have that technology back in 1997. So, you know, if it probably wasn't, see, and here's the thing, you could have an infrared event if you took a bunch of junk from an old A-10 and cut it up in pieces and dropped it off in a off a helicopter at a certain altitude and just, you know, threw off a couple flares or whatever, or let out a fire or whatever you want to do with it, you know what I mean? It's not really that difficult to do if you want to divert attention away from something that really happened. Hold on one second. Because the last thing you want to do as President of the United States is announce to the American public that an A-10 Warthog jet has disappeared with four live 500 MK 500-pound bombs.
Okay, now, that's the question. If that plane did not crash, where did it go? Where is it today?
Well, some of the initial reports, if you actually go back like I did, collected every single report that was ever done on it, actually speculated that the plane had landed somewhere and offloaded its bombs, that there was actually some sort of terrorist, you know, sort of slant on this, which was quickly buried. And so I think the big mystery here is, well, there's a couple of mysteries, but, you know, if you look at the reactions of the government, they went on a witch hunt to blame this on. I mean, they came up with all kinds of anonymous sources from the Pentagon who said he was having a gay homosexual love affair. He was.
Did that turn out to be true?
None of it turned out to be true. Not one single allegation that had come forward in CNN and other types of stories that came forward. And it pissed off. I don't know if I could say that. I apologize. But
that's okay. If the FCC didn't like it, they'll charge you $350,000.
That's all?
That's all.
My bad.
Per station. Good luck.
They come get it. They were so disgusted with the way that, you know, everything was being handled that they made a pact that they would never speak to, you know, to journalists about what had happened to their son And mind you, his Craig Button's father, at one time they were saying that Craig Button was having emotional problems because his parents were Jehovah's Witnesses, but they had been Jehovah's Witnesses for like 20 years, and his father was actually a U.S. Air Force captain himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every story that they basically put out a slander campaign to slander this guy, and then when they ran out of slander options, they basically said he committed suicide. You know, I have evidence, and I've seen evidence that there is a whole other story that goes on with this particular story that I can't really talk about right now. But you know, definitely, it is something that Congress should really look into. And again, this is one of those things, because you have a UFO tinge or a UFO element associated with it, no one will look into it. It's the perfect cover-up for what's going on with the military-industrial complex, because all of this really boils down to money. You know, they want to cover up the money that they've been spending on these secret back engineering projects.
All right. So, but he's in an A-10. That's not a back engineered project.
No, but
in fact, the A-10 is what they call the Warthog.
That's right. A-10 Thunderbolt 2 is an anti-tank killing machine, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it is specifically designed to carry a lot of weight, a lot of armament, a lot of bombs, has a titanium shell, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the connections to the Phoenix Lights events is that, to get back to the story here, within the story, is shortly after Craig Button had disappeared and they pronounced him dead, and that was sort of wrapped up and put in the bottle, which was in April of 1997. In June, finally, you know, many months after all these events had occurred, in June of 1997, the story about the Phoenix Lights began to break nationwide. And no sooner did the story of the Phoenix Lights break, but the UFO, the U.S. Air Force turns around literally like, I can't remember if it was the same day or a couple of days later, but it turned around literally and said they were going to release the 50-year Roswell report, you know, debunking the Roswell incident. And before you know it, the Air Force comes out and says, well, actually, you know, we had A-10s flying up in the sky on March 13th, 1997, and you know, they were dropping flares that night. So everything that was seen on March 13th was one of those A-10 flares. And that's what really piqued my interest, because it was the A-10 pilots that were getting knocked off, it seems like, right? Because 2 weeks prior to Craig Button disappearance, on March 18th, 1997, another A-10 went down. On May...
All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, William Warrick IV, and we're talking now about an incident that took place in 1997, 2 weeks after the event that has come to be known by many folks as the Phoenix Lights event. And the event we're talking about that took place 2 weeks after that is the disappearance of a U.S. Air Force jet and its pilot, and four live 500-pound bombs. William, no seismic event. In other words, the seismographs didn't register a plane crash. They didn't register any of these four bombs hitting the ground. Absolutely no evidence that there was a crash. And then you've got the Air Force coming out and saying, well, we had an infrared event, and we went looking in that area, and they say they found some wreckage there. But you're not buying that.
None of it adds up.
Okay, why not?
Because if Craig Button or whoever was in control of the craft, or even if he wasn't in control of the craft, which was speculated at one time, his maneuvers, his observed maneuvers indicate otherwise, that someone was in control of the craft, whether it was Craig Button or not, we don't know. But if it had crashed into the side of the mountain at, 300, 400 miles per hour, or even 200 miles per hour, that would have definitely shown up on a seismograph in the area. And they would be able to triangulate that particular source of that particular, disturbance and be able to triangulate, where it occurred. And there was no indication of any seismographic readings for that particular day that would indicate that either any of the four bombs, nor the aircraft itself crashing. And now, you have to remember, the bombs were never recovered, and they spent a lot of time looking for those bombs.
And I think we need to say to the folks that these were not dummy bombs. These were loaded.
These were live, what would be called live bombs. They were called, they're MK-500 bombs, so they're dumb bombs in the sense that they're not like GPS guided, they're not JDAMs, they're just regular road, a fuse on it that's probably set for the altitude. When it reaches below a certain altitude, it goes off, et cetera, et cetera. But these were live, bombs that could be theoretically, if the plan was landed on an airport, taken off of the aircraft, dismantled, and used for the explosives that were inside of them, which I believe is cordite.
Okay, so we have 2,000 pounds of high explosives.
Cordite.
Yeah.
Specifically. And you could do a lot of damage with 2,000 pounds of cordite. I mean, it's a military-grade explosive. One of the interesting things, just as a little side note, and you can read into whatever you want, that the Pentagon people, when the 9/11 attacks occurred at the Pentagon, described distinctly smelling cordite. It has a very distinct smell. And they all reported smelling that. So what's cordite doing on a passenger airplane? Let's ask that question.
Pretty good question, isn't it? Okay, so 2 weeks before Craig Button's plane disappears, with Craig Button, we have the Phoenix Lights. And then we have that story that comes out. First, we didn't have any planes in the area. We don't know what's going on. And then the next story is, oh yeah, we had the National Guard from Maryland was dropping flares.
But we didn't know about it because they were actually dropping on the Goldwater Test Range, and the name of the flight was called Snowbird, Operation Snowbird, I believe, right? And Snowbird was, as many ufologists or anyone who studied military history will know, was a code word that was used back in the 50s for a decoy action to make regular aircraft be reported as UFOs to keep it away from the communist intelligence agencies, keep it under the wire, so to speak. And so, there's one particular, also very important loss of another pilot, decorated Air Force pilot from the same base that Craig Button was from, just prior to the June 21st story that the Air Force released from Lucas Air Force Base, admitting that there was a Maryland Air National Guard 8-10 force up in the sky at night, even though they weren't up in the sky at the right times when the flares occurred, right? Well, Craig Button's, apparently, from all the everything I can indicate, and someone tells me otherwise, apparently his trainer, because remember, he was training at the base, even though he had flown, different missions, and he was a decorated pilot. He was training at that base for a couple of quite a while. I believe he'd been there 3 or 4 months at that particular period of time. And Amy Lynn Svoboda, who was one of the first female jet pilots for our country, allegedly, through quote-unquote pilot error, on May 27, 1997, again, just 6 weeks after Craig Button allegedly disappeared with his A-10, allegedly she, through pilot error, crashed herself into the ground. Just 6 weeks after, apparently his trainee, or her trainee, disappeared and allegedly committed suicide by crashing his plane into a mountain. Well, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, that's what really piqued my interest, because then it becomes like, whoa, you know, what are we really dealing with here? Because that story, she was killed before the story came out about the A-10s and the Luke Air Force Base. And the first thing you would do if you were involved in something that you're unsure about in the military is you go to your commanding officer. If you don't go to your commanding officer and you go around your commanding officer, 9 times out of 10, you're going to nip it in the butt. So if something had occurred and he was involved in it, or they were involved in it, the first person that he would go to would be his immediate commanding officer, what I would assume would be his trainer, who in this case would be Amy Lynn Savota, and they're both dead.
All right, I've got a question for you. What's your theory? What happened to them and why?
All right. How much time do we have?
We have 22 minutes till the end of the show.
22 minutes to the end of the show.
Yeah, but we got a break coming up, too, so...
Well, if we go into the predilication that obviously something happened to those bombs. They weren't recovered, so someone's got the bombs. Someone wanted to do something with those bombs, what would you want to do with it? If you were a terrorist organization or some type of other black ops operation, what would you, you know, what could you possibly use that for? Well, obviously, you can use those as explosives, you know. And, you know, the thing that kind of piqued my interest was the description of the Pentagon people. Again, this isn't my stuff. This is their own words from documented testimony. A lot of the witnesses and the people that were in the Pentagon when it was attacked on 9/11 described spelling cordite.
Mm-hmm.
And they would know. You know what I mean?
Well, you would think they would know. They buy the stuff.
Well, I mean, these are veterans. These are guys mm-hmm. who are veterans who are saying, look, I know what cordite smells like. It has a very distinct smell, and I smell cordite, you know, and I don't know why I smell cordite if this was a civilian plane hitting, you know, a reinforced part. And here's another thing, too. The part of the facility of the Pentagon that was hit was undergoing construction to be reinforced. Well, let's go back to what happened the day before 9/11. The day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld announced to the American people that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon budget that they couldn't account for.
Mm-hmm.
So I have heard, and I have had sources tell me, that what was in that particular part of the Pentagon was actually the records of what and where the money went. And so by taking that out, and by blaming it on the Muslims, whatever part they may have had in it, you know, Osama bin Laden, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Al-Qaeda, which they probably did, although they probably had no idea to what effect it was going to have, you know, with them, which is another old ploy of the military deception game, then basically, you know, you've eliminated, not only have you diverted attention away from the $2.3 trillion that's missing, but now you've diverted attention into a protracted war where you can divert another 25% of every dollar that was sent to Afghanistan or Iraq. By the government's own accounting office, they say that 25% of all that money can't be accounted for. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars
mm-hmm.
since the war, quote-unquote, war on terror began, all as a result of the attacks that occurred on 9/11, irregardless of who was responsible for those attacks. So
you don't see a connection between the disappearance of Craig Button and his aircraft with, you don't see a connection with the Phoenix incident, the Phoenix Lights incident?
Oh, yeah. I think he was part of that. I think he was told to go up and fly his aircraft at a certain, he programmed something into his attack ground computer, or it was programmed in there for him, and he was told to go up on a routine training flight, and someone remotely activated that air-to-ground computer and, you know, controlled it, you know, had it fly a set pattern at a set time and drop those flares at a set rate to make it look like there was something else in the sky.
Yeah, but he disappeared 2 weeks later.
He disappeared 2 weeks later, correct, because he tried to blow the whistle on it.
Oh, okay. Now, how did he try to blow the whistle on it?
I can't talk about that. Not now, at least.
Okay, but you have information that he did try to blow the whistle on it?
Yes.
Okay, so that would have been an admission that...
Let me be more clear on that. He reported that he was not in control of his aircraft.
Okay, he reported he was not in control of his aircraft.
Correct.
When? I mean, when was he not in control of it?
Prior to his disappearance.
Okay. During the alleged Maryland National Guard flight dropping flares, during that period of time?
That I don't know. All I can tell you at this particular point in the investigation is that he was not in control of his aircraft, and that he was very upset about that, and that he had reached out to get some guidance on that, and he was dead the next day. Well, let's just say he disappeared the next day.
Interesting. Very, very interesting.
And I really wish I could go into more of that. I know that, you know, but I do take my sources very seriously. And you know, I've made a commitment since day one, and you know this, that, you know, I'm not going to reveal sources. I'm not going to, you know, until the time is right, until we have enough evidence and we can, you know, really put some kind of nail in the coffin. So at this point in time, that's as much as I can tell you.
Yes, and you have to be careful, because the coffin you may put a nail in may be yours.
Well, I mean, you know, if they were going to do that, they would have done it by now a long time ago. You know, there are certain people that want these things to come out just as much as there are certain people that don't want them to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I firmly, let's just say, believe that there are good things and there are bad things in this world, and I hope that I've made the good things a little better and the bad things a little less. So, but that's what's going on, and he was not in control of his aircraft. And it also, you know, would allude to the fact or to the reasoning of what happened to Ambulance Svoboda, who allegedly crashed her own due to pilot error. Again, the implication is that one of these A-10 attack aircraft may have been used to attack the Pentagon, and that the 400 pounds of cordite, or I should say 2,000 pounds of cordite from the four different bombs, might have been used in the four different separate attacks or disasters, or whatever you want to call it, that occurred on 9/11.
All right. We have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach here this evening, and my guest is William Warrick IV. Now, William, we spent the first hour and 10 minutes or so talking about Fatima and how that's connected to UFOs in your view, and you explained, I think, quite well why you think it is a UFO event. And now we're talking about this A-10 jet aircraft that disappeared with four bombs and a pilot, and 2 weeks after the Phoenix Lights incident. There is apparently, from what you say, rather cryptically, some connection between that and the Phoenix Lights. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so there is some connection there.
Well, the connection is that Craig Button was probably an unwitting participant in what has since become known as the flare drop theory, where the lights that were seen, the 10 p.m. videos that were seen all over the world, were actually flares being dropped from an A-10. And so that he, by his indication that he was not in control of his aircraft, was indicating that he was probably, and again, I'm speculating here, the only thing that I know for sure is that he was not in control of his aircraft.
Okay.
And you could speculate a lot of different things from that point on, but it would indicate, obviously, that perhaps he was either a participant or a witness or had knowledge of the cover operation that was going on to divert attention away from the actual UFO sightings and events which occur around 8:30 rather than 10 p.m. flare drops. So it's,
and what do you think the connection would be with his trainer? What's her connection to it?
She's a trainer. She saw something too. That would be my speculation. And whatever control they had over his craft, they used the same type of mechanism to control her craft and cause it to fly herself into the ground and make it look like pilot error.
Mm-hmm. Well, pilots pilots do make errors.
All the time. All mm-hmm. the time. Absolutely. There's no question of that. But, and again, this wasn't just isolated to this particular Air Force base. Later on September 16th, 1997, Defense Secretary Cohen, at the time, ordered an immediate halting of all non-critical, non-combat, tactical air operations throughout the whole military, basically a stand-down. And it had never happened, but actually it happened once before in late 1996. But those are the only two times it's ever happened, a total stand-down. And that was only following a string of seven crashes, one of which involved the crash of a C-130 Orion spy plane with a German similarly outfitted spy plane over the middle of the Atlantic in the middle of the daytime. So you have two of the most sophisticated aircraft on Earth, sensing, etc., listening device aircraft, etc., crashing into each other over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, followed by, seven other crashes, the next day, day after day after day after day. So clearly there was something going on involving whatever was going on with the UFOs. I've heard, and I've come to the conclusion that we basically were kind of at a stand-down situation with whoever the visitors were or are. And that's what happened. It explains all the crashes. It explains, the escalation of events leading up to the March 13th sightings and then similar events that occurred afterwards. And that still continues to this day. We still have, idle stories of reports of pilots that are mysteriously disappearing, so to speak, that are connected to UFO events. There have been a number of them. Fighting Tiger 524, Troubleshooter 516, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are relatively recent. Troubleshooter 516 occurred on the same night as March 13th, 1997, at 11 p.m. off the coast of Norfolk. So there's definitely something going on, and it involves UFOs in our airspace that our military, according to the former Prime Minister of Canada, Defense Minister of Canada, who I've met, Paul Hellyer, says, we're basically going out and trying to attack these UFOs without really taking into account the consequences of our actions. And we may be escalating this into, a fight that we can't, we're not really prepared to fight because we have a standing policy within our military to try to shoot these things down whenever we're incompetent.
Yeah, it may be something akin to a chihuahua trying to fight a lion.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why we're doing it is not out of a defense standpoint. It's because we want to get their technology. We want to shoot that thing down and try and back engineer whatever, technology they have. So it's really based on the greed aspect of the military industrial complex, again, overshadowing everything else.
How do you know that?
Because it's the only thing that can explain
What if they know something about these people that are flying these craft that makes our people convinced that it's a threat?
Well, what if it's a manufactured threat?
Well, it could be that too.
Well, the second reason is why would they even threat if they're that powerful and that strong? Do they really need to threaten us? I mean, how hard would it be to drop 12, hydrogen bombs from space onto Earth, and wipe out the whole human civilization? I don't know that would be an issue for them. I don't know why they would go through the ruse of trying to deceive us, and certainly not continue a deception that would go on for 60 or 70 years or even 1,000 years, really, if you look mm-hmm. at it through the course of history and time.
Well, you make a good point. You make a good point. All right. Well, William, we've got about four minutes left. And I want to give you the opportunity to sort of sum up what is all this about. What's your point here with Fatima and with the A-10s and the Phoenix situation? What's the point of it all?
Well, the one the one common denominator that I've, again, knowing all that I know about it, have learned about it, I should say, still have a lot to learn, but is that apparently there was a numerological thing going on with the Fatima events, which was basically that the encounters between the children and the visitors, let's call them, were to occur on the 13th of every month. And, of course, the 13th of each month for 5 or 6 months in a row occurs on a different day of the month, and sometimes it's 30 or 31 days, et cetera, et cetera. So that sort of piqued my interest. One of the other things that piqued my interest was that October 13th is also the day, obviously, that, as many people will know, that the Knights Templars were rounded up and disbanded by the Papal Church. So if you think of the third secret in terms of the apostasy of the church, which basically means the corruption of the church or the revelation of the corruption of the church, in that context, then it certainly would appear that the revelation of these angelic beings being, you know, extraterrestrial humans or whatever you want to call them, from not humans, but extraterrestrials visiting with humans and interacting them would cause the downfall of the church. And
30 seconds.
Oh, we got 30 seconds. Well, basically, the Mayan end calendar date is 13.0.0.0.0. And so if you extrapolate what might be the message that they're trying to communicate to us as humans outside of government interference, is that we should look forward to that date as an ominous date. I don't know what's going to happen on that day. I don't think anybody does, but it certainly seems like that would be the message that they were trying to communicate just by the actions of the numerological apparitions that they have occurred. And again, you have the March 13th, 1997 Phoenix lights, which represent the resurrection, so to speak.
All right. Thanks for being with us. If you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be a wrap for this evening, and that's William Warrick IV, and we appreciate him being with us to talk about something from a little bit different perspective, a lot different perspective, perhaps, for some of you. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you'd like. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.